Hi, my name's Cameron Cozon, and this is the Lager Podcast, where we interview hardware leaders on their personal journeys and their career-defining hardware projects. But before we jump in, if you are a hardware team or if writing firmware is part of your job, then head over to LagerData, LagerData.com, and we will both literally and figuratively change your life for the better. That's LagerData.com. On today's episode, we interview Jake Levine, currently a product manager at Facebook Reality Labs, but before that, founder and CEO of one of my all-time favorite hardware companies, Electric Objects. I still have mine, it kind of works, and I love it. I also love Jake in this conversation, and I hope you do too. Jake, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm going to take you back, Jake. I'm just going to take you back to those baby years.
Back in time.
Yeah. What I found out by doing just a little bit of research ahead of our podcast here is I've known you for a while, but I didn't realize you started out in finance. And so you started out as like a little brolet, you know, just kind of like getting your baby bro wings. And then pretty quickly, though, and I'm actually curious to hear why, pretty quickly, you left investment and strategy and switch to like an EIR role at Betawork. What made you do that? How did you find out about it? How did you jump into entrepreneurship so quickly?
So I was in investment banking. I worked at Morgan Stanley, and I lucked into the tech financing group because I was kind of like following an investment banking track. And for some reason, I thought it was like a good way to get into the tech industry at the time, which was, I guess it worked out, but it wasn't, it's not the obvious choice. So there I was, you know, wearing my slacks every day and my BlackBerry around my belt. This was like on the eve of the iPhone. And so we were still BlackBerrying for a brief stint. It was also in the middle of the Great Recession. So not a great time to be an investment banker.
No.
If any time is good time to be an investment banker. And I got laid off after a year. And I was like, you know, I totally get it. Like, it's a Great Recession. And they were like, it's not because of the recession. They were like, you just clearly don't want to be here. And so you should probably go. And it was a real shock to the ego, but also like a great push out the door.
Do they make you hand back your BlackBerry? Do you have to like hand back your BlackBerry and my badge?
My badge and my gun. My badge and my email gun. And one of our clients at the time was the CEO of an internet company, one of the few kind of like rising internet stars at the time, a company called The Ladders in New York City. And So I you know, shortly after jumping ship from banking or being thrown off the ship, I called him up and he was like, you know, I have this like chief of staff role and you might be a good fit for it. And so I ended up joining him for a great experience. Like, I always, you know, tell kids that are graduating or like really anyone, like if you have an opportunity to go be a chief of staff for someone who you like admire, it's a great opportunity to just learn a lot really quickly. And
what does a chief of staff do? That's like an embarrassing question. Maybe I actually,
good question. I mean, it's probably totally different depending on like where you are in your career and who the person you're supporting is. And actually, I think my title was strategic development analyst, which didn't mean much, but it was basically like be an external brain for this person. And if they're interested in something, help chase down some research. If they want to model something out, help them do that. If they're having trouble with a certain part of the organization, like go in there and figure out how to help. It was cool. And like one day when I'm a real executive, I'd love a young whippersnapper to be my chief of staff. But ultimately, just like a great way to get into internet stuff. And after about a year and a half, got the itch to do my own internet thing and connected with the team at Betaworks, which was and is sort of a weird hybrid of an incubator, studio, venture fund in New York City. At the time, it was the sort of cool hotbed of social web policy, internet stuff. That's where Cameron and I met. And I was just like in awe of the place. And when John, the CEO, gave me the opportunity to be really an entrepreneur in residence is like a made up title. And it was really made up for someone who's 2 years out of school. But it was a very nice title to have for a brief stint. And it gave me the opportunity to meet a bunch of people at Betaworks and find a team that I was excited about and join them on the journey of making an app back when apps were the thing that everyone made.
I actually met you then right when I think you were in EIR. I don't think I realized like,
oh wow,
just how recently, but you and I went to that restaurant, the fancy hotel, the Standard. We went to the Standard and you were talking about being in EIR and like looking for a team and looking for an opportunity. And what struck me even then, which is also, I think, super interesting for why you were a chief of staff, is I was just like, man, this guy is like an operator. This guy knows how to like get things done, which is not a thing that I'm good at. I'm like way more like big ideas, like lots of talking kind of stuff. And, but I was like, wow, he's saying words that I didn't even know. Oh yeah, definitely. He probably makes things happen, which was cool. And I remember a little bit being like, yeah, but what is his, what cool ideas does he have? Cause this is like, whatever, right. 10 years ago or something.
Right.
But we'll get to that. You had a cool idea that we're going to talk about. How did you ultimately decide on one of those apps, one of those app things?
2011, 12, the App Store was like 1-2 years old. The iPad was just coming out. So everyone was trying to reinvent reading on a tablet. Another big thing that probably gets lost in history is that Apple had launched subscriptions in their App Store for the first time, which had unlocked lots of ideas about media business models. And so we were building, actually, this was a product that came out of the New York Times R&D lab, and Betaworks sort of like pulled it out of the New York Times and decided to, and, you know, found a way to incubate it within their studio. And I joined a couple engineers that had come from the New York Times, and we built this thing that fed off of social data from Facebook and Twitter to produce a personalized stream of news, and we would sell a subscription. And like most news ventures, I think it was very high-minded, and we're going to like rescue
journalism
from the jaws of polarization and, you know, radical misinformation. And
that worked. You know, you did it.
And it worked. And yeah, we did it.
That's not a thing we're contending with.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that. That was news.me, right? That's what this is called. News.me.
It was news.me, and the team ultimately we acquired Dig and became Dig, which was the fabled newsreader of the web 2.0 era.
Yeah.
That preceded Reddit and a lot of other social communities. I think they claim to have invented the like button, or, you know, in the form of the Dig. So that's why they're famous. We're famous for buying them when they were about to die and breathing some life into them.
So they're still like, alive. I checked before the thing. They're still cooking.
They're still kicking. I still see people who are like, oh, Dig. Yeah, I check Dig all the time. So it's still got some audience. But yeah, it wasn't, I think like many of my projects during that time, it was, you know, you said like, he's such a, you know, such a good operator, but no ideas. Like, you know, we were leaning on the ideas at that point, which were like maybe a good starting point, but, and this is probably like a lesson that carries through to Electric Objects, like a good starting point, but the hard work of like product development and finding your market and letting go of your religion around your original idea is something that is just like a pattern throughout my career and something I've learned a lot from. You're convincing people to change their lives to come work for you. You're like, yeah. Hey, leave your comfortable job at Google, give up hundreds of thousands of dollars to work on this specific mission and this specific implementation. And then 6 months later, if you're like confronted with the idea that you might be wrong, you can't listen to that, because that would mean that you're letting all these people down and your investors who you sold on a particular direction. And like, you have so much invested personally, emotionally in your original idea that letting go of that is so hard and feels like such a tragedy. But it's also, I think what I've learned is that it's just also like how you make a business successful.
Yeah. So you were doing news.me, you jumped into Dig. That just sort of landed in your lap, essentially. That was like a weird Betaworks only opportunity.
It was a weird Betaworks thing. John, the CEO of Betaworks, has a nose for these kinds of opportunities. I flew out to San Francisco and met with the CEO, and we whiteboarded the sort of like future vision for Dig. And it was the weirdest experience. I walked into this massive office in which there worked a secretary, the CEO, and a few consultants hanging around the kitchen who just did not look like they belonged in a tech startup with their Blackberries on their belts and their button down, you know, in their slacks. But so it was a very weird, like Silicon Valley episode version of a failed or imploded tech startup. But we acquired it, and it was something like the cost of our team was about $100,000 a month. It was a pretty small team. And the data centers to support Dig were about $150,000 a month. And so had 6 weeks from the time the acquisition closed to completely rewrite the tech stack on top of AWS so that we could basically make the deal worthwhile, because otherwise it would have been too expensive.
6 weeks.
So that was a wild 6 week. Like, we built an iPhone app. We built a website for millions of people. We built a new email product. We were building on top of the news.me work, but it was a wild sprint. There was one moment when Alex Lines, who is now a partner at Notation Capital, I have a great photo of him with like blood on his keyboard because he was typing so aggressively.
Oh, shit.
It got real. I mean, he's an intense guy anyways, but it got pretty intense during that sprint. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience. Like, great group of people who've all gone on to do awesome things.
it did well, right? Like, I feel like for something that was about to go away, it turned it around into like a pretty good little business.
I kind of actually moved off of it after short, like maybe within a year of launch, because I had the idea to do electric objects and had some personal stuff that had me kind of like questioning the current role at Dig and at Betaworks. You know, we tried to kind of go it alone and build a media business. The ambitions were pretty high or aggressive, and I don't think it met the sort of ambitions. It could have probably been a great 10 million monthly unique, maybe 20 million monthly unique business, but it's really hard to build like a big media business on top of those kinds of numbers. So it is what it is, but shifted gears to electric objects, which if you want to pick a more challenging business than media, it was like, great, let's do a hardware company that is also a media company.
Yeah. And like an art media company. It's like a,
yeah, just a confluence of terrible ideas. No, a great idea at the confluence of three incredibly challenging areas for any business or startup.
So our mutual friend, Lauren, told me to ask you, I was like, what should I be asking Jake? And she said that maybe in between Betaworks and EO, you had another important venture that's a big part of your legacy.
Yeah.
Something to do with texting.
Yeah. No, that's, thank you so much. This is what I'm most proud of. During that period of time when I was sort of fading away from Dig and thinking about doing my own thing, it was kind of the most like fertile creative period, you know, of my career. And I often think back to it and wonder what combination of naivete and ambition and pure kind of, I don't know, creative energy led me to have such a fruitful period that ultimately resulted in electric objects. But along the way was highlighted by the release of an app that I think you're referring to called Breakup Text.
Yeah, that's it.
Which, you know, at the time, if you wanted to break up with someone over text, you had to get your phone out of your pocket. You had to pull up the person's name. You had to write the message and then you had to send it. What we offered was an app that made it really easy to, by answering a few simple questions and picking the person from your address book, it would fire off a really thoughtful, very long, dramatic text message that was funny because when we released it, it got some press coverage from folks in the tech industry as like kind of like, ahaha, isn't this funny? And then it was picked up by like local news media. It was actually the most interesting media experiment I had ever done because it was picked up by all these local news media who thought it was real and who didn't bother to click through to whatever they were looking at to understand that it was satire.
Yeah.
And we started showing up on like random like CBS affiliates with like, this just in, you know, here's what the kids are making now. Like, can you believe that they're breaking up with people over text message? I think it made its way into like a Jimmy Fallon segment and was on other talk shows. And oh yeah, it was like my most notable achievement by far. Thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah, you're welcome. So riding that high, you say, okay, moving from satire into art, what was the like aha moment for electric objects? Like what got you thinking about it and how'd you kind of get up the courage to do it?
Giphy, actually, funny enough, because the end of the story also ends with Giphy, but Giphy was started right next door to us at Dig in within Betaworks. And I remember seeing one day their page of artists that they had collaborated with and would look through the GIFs that the artists were making. And I thought they were amazing. And I thought to myself, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you could throw this GIF on your wall and have it like art?
Yeah.
And I tweeted it out and a bunch of people, I forget if it was a fave at that point, not a heart, but a bunch of people faved it and retweeted it. And so that kind of stuck in my head. And when it came time for me to work on some side projects, I thought, you know, hardware is kind of cool now. Like investors are investing in hardware. I think it's kind of interesting to build something physical. Maybe as a little side project, I'll build a photo frame that can play an animated GIF, or at least the software that can sort of send an animated GIF from my computer to a photo frame. And I started researching photo frames and none of them could play animated GIFs. So I said, maybe I'll just like, you know, how hard can it be? I'll just build my own. And so I bought a Raspberry Pi and got a monitor and stripped it apart and connected them. And, you know, I think I probably like, you know, used the basic Raspberry Pi operating system and wrote a little script that sent a GIF to the screen. And it was like glorious seeing that for the first time. And so that was the sort of origin of the general idea. And then I think as I was sort of thinking about it and hacking on it, I started giving it to some friends and we started talking about what was special about it. And there was something about taking a digital object, which was so ephemeral and so fleeting and so that felt so kind of like shallow on the internet, and putting it on your wall sort of totally changed your relationship to it. It started to feel more real, more physical. Those are the words people would use to describe it, like more valuable. And in there was the insight that like, oh, well, wow, if we're making these things more valuable, maybe we can get people to buy them or get people to sort of value them in a new way. And at the same time, just thinking about like, man, why is it that I have a favorite musician and a favorite album and a favorite book and a favorite author and a favorite movie and a favorite video game? And I can't name a single artist whose work hangs on my wall.
In particular, like a digital artist, it seems like.
Yeah. Or any artist, like any visual artist, like ask a random person on the street and say like, what art hangs on your wall? Like I'm looking at like in my room right now, I have a New Yorker poster. Like, could I tell you who made that? I have no idea.
No.
Right. And so like, why is it that this one category of media is so inaccessible to so many people? And why is it that this one category of media is defined by its scarcity more than like where value is defined by scarcity more than abundance? And that was what was messed up to me. And that I thought, you know, was like a mission I could get excited about beyond just like a cool kind of product. So that was the sort of origin of it. And it sort of snowballed, and the BetaWorks crew helped me get it off the ground when it was really nothing.
So you took your prototype maybe and went to John and said, hey, John, like, here's what I think this can be. And I do remember hardware being like a thing and being like,
yeah, it was a thing
popular then. Yeah. And I'm hoping its popularity returns in a way. Basically, you take your prototype and you go to John Borthwick and you're like, hey, check out how cool this is. Like, is that all it took? Or what was that conversation like when you were trying to change it from, or even how did you decide to go from toy to business?
I remember actually being in a conference room with Nick Churls, who's the other notation partner.
Nice.
At BetaWorks at the time. And it was, I had a friend who was sort of like incubating my product in his house. Actually, I was like working out of his home in off Tompkins Square Park. And he's sort of this brilliant creative mind, like a really inspiring person. He actually has a product called Oda right now that everyone should check out. It's a new hardware product. He and Nick and I got together and just got confident together in the notion that this might be a thing, or that the sort of mission was worth pursuing, and that the appetite from investors was there to support it. Or at least, you know, insofar as to say, like, let's build out some prototypes and see if there's real demand here. I was pretty hesitant to show John, the BetaWorks CEO, because I wanted, you know, I was nervous and I wanted it to be ready and for him to really get the experience. And at some point, I think Nick just tipped him off to it, or he heard about it. And he was like, hey, I want to come by and see it. And so I was a little nervous and he came by and I showed him the demo. And at that point, I think it was a Raspberry Pi, a screen, and a website. Maybe it worked on the phone, but you know, just like showing him that you could send a GIF from the computer to your wall. At that point, I had made some like pretty, I think, important design decisions. One was, you know, there was the plastic was ripped off, so it didn't look like a monitor. And one of the aha moments was we hung it in portrait, which also kind of made it feel less like a TV and less like a computer. And so even without like any back, there was no back to it. There were, you know, it was kind of raw, but just those two changes alone, I think, made it feel less like a normal screen. And so John came over and saw it and he was like, thank God you're not doing the text message thing. He was like, he was worried I was trying to turn that into a startup or something. And he was super excited about it. And they decided to put in at the time, I guess you'd call it a pre-seed round now, but it was enough to, you know, help me get it off the ground and get some good people around it.
I think it's nice that the strength of conviction for an idea often just comes from the friends around you.
Hmm.
It can be hard on your own to get there. And it's cool to hear that your buddy with the Oda thing and Nick were there to like help you kind of say, oh no, that you're not too crazy here. There's something worth like exploring. Who joined your initial team?
I had no idea what I was doing. I was like, okay, I knew how to build a software team and I knew how to build an app and I knew how to hire designers. And I had no idea what kind of hardware person I needed. I think I reached out to Tyler Mincy, who is one of the other guests on this show, and he was an advisor in the early days and helped me build my hardware team. I found this guy named Bill, who he had a kind of strange background. He was like part mechanical engineer, part industrial designer. He was working at Crestron out in New Jersey, and he was intrigued by the idea of joining a tiny startup. So I found him, and then I found a curator named Zoe. And we were the original kind of founding team, and Bill immediately set to work building out, you know, what would a sort of actual manufacturable version of this product look like. And he was fantastic. He could do design, mechanical engineering. He did operation. Like he and I together did the sort of ops and logistics for the first generation of the product. Meanwhile, Zoe went out and built out a great collection of artists to work with. and I brought on another couple people to help build out the software experience, which was pretty complicated because in order to have a hardware product in the home that connects to the internet, you can't just support iOS, right? You have to unless you want to limit your market to people who also have iPhones. So we had an Android engineer building the app and the Android operating system for the device itself. We had an iOS engineer building an iOS app. We had full stack engineers building the web and the back end for everything. It was a big effort, like across a bunch of different disciplines, and required a startup team that was probably like 2 to 3x the normal size of a startup team just to get it off the ground. Which I mentioned, like, you know, our round at the time would be today a pre-seed round. It's even at that moment, we weren't set up for success. It's something that, like, at the time I had no idea, but I feel like I walked backwards into every fundraising round and didn't really understand that what I was signing up for and the commitment that I was making to reach the next level. And that, like, even then, I think the seeds of our like challenging future were sown.
Very apocryphal. I love the way that sounds. Apocryphal is not the right word, but it's very...
No, I get the point. Yeah.
I want to try to say that back to you so I'm certain I understand. Is one aspect of what you're saying that you feel like maybe because you'd underestimated the financial needs of hardware, you were already behind from your first fundraise, like, because you had done a pre-seed. And so, like, even by the time, you're always playing catch up and you never had a moment to be like out in front and ahead.
Yeah. And this was, you know, the target was moving also, right? Like, what it took to raise a seed round when I was starting was different than what it took to raise a seed round 2 years later. And I think my seed investors, even 6 months in, were like, ooh, we should have done a bigger round.
Yeah.
And they knew even then that, you know, it was going to take longer and be more expensive to reach what a Series A investor would expect. And the reality is that, like, venture capital is built on top of software companies.
Yeah.
Like, that's their bread and butter. And software companies have this amazing property where you don't have to pay for every unit you sell. And so you need that much more growth as a hardware company. You need that much more margin as a hardware company to compete with a kind of product that doesn't cost anything to grow. And that's what investors are comparing you to. And it's really hard to compete with that, right? You're ultimately, investors are deciding where to put their capital for the best return on investment. And over here, you've got something that costs $100 every time you sell a unit. And over here, you've got something that costs $0 every time you sell a unit, which means the cost of growth in the latter are just so much more, infinitely more attractive. You need to show so much more growth, so much more potential for it to be worth it for an investor to put the money in the hardware company versus the software company, which makes it difficult to raise enough money. The other issue is that if you don't raise enough money, you can't show enough growth to raise enough money the next time.
Yes.
And so it's a really difficult trap that unless you start out with a big, big chunk of money, which you see a lot of the successful hardware startups of the last like 5 years they've always raised a little bit beyond their traction or a lot beyond their traction. Peloton is a good example. Mirror is a good example. And they've done it on sheer belief, right? Like the belief in the team or belief in the market or belief in the product. There are examples of companies that have been slower and more methodical. Like GoPro was like 7 or 8 years before they raised a big round. MakerBot, right, was like a long time before they raised a lot of money. There are totally ways to do it, but we were sort of neither. We were neither like the slow and methodical, raise a little bit of money, let the revenue grow your business, and then once you reach a critical mass, raise a bunch of money. Nor were we raise a ton of money out of the gate to fund a bunch of mistakes early on to reach the point where you can raise even more money.
I remember it had been a year or two since I had seen you, and I ran into you in Cobble Hill, and you were in the middle of one of your raises. I don't think it was like your last one. I think it was maybe the first big one after the pre-seed or whatever. You were pretty emphatic about how difficult it was and how little maybe you liked it. And I don't know if you can go back to that place. Was hardware still exciting at that time, or was there like a visible turn? And what kind of things were you hearing that was making it more difficult for you to raise, basically?
When I raised the pre-seed, which was $200,000 from Betaworks, I was their first or maybe second hardware investment. When I raised my seed, with First Round Capital, which is like an amazing fund, and I love them. And Finn Barnes is the partner that I worked with there, and he's great.
Oh yeah, he's cool.
You know, I was his first hardware investment, so I was everyone's first mistake.
Yes,
and I think Finn bought into it on the basis of the product experience. And for me, I think I was like, I was so naive. I think I was like, okay, for my seed, I think if I just get another $500,000, I'll be able to ship this, and then we should ship it and then see if anyone wants it and then decide if we should go raise more money, which is just like, my math was so off and my understanding of the venture markets was so off. But regardless, like, you know, we ended up raising $1.5 million, which felt like so much money to me at the time. In hindsight, that should have been $3 million at that stage. If I actually wanted to, you know, show enough progress to, you know, raise another round the next time around. And that wasn't so hard of a round. Like, first round came in pretty quickly, but it was still extremely stressful. So that was probably, so it was 2014 when we raised our seed, maybe it was 2016 or something when we raised our Series A of about 5 million, which also felt like so much money, but I think I had gone through 60 or 70 no's before I got someone to believe.
Oh my God.
And again, it was just sheerly like belief. You know, we had done a Kickstarter. It had shown, you know, we'd sold almost $1 million worth of the product, but it wasn't enough. Like, by the time my Kickstarter had gone out and been successful, one of my investors sat me down and said, like, you sold like $700,000 on Kickstarter. Congratulations. Like, that's how you get the meeting with the venture capitalists, right? Like, that's the basic expectation, you know, yeah, to even have a conversation. You need to tell a story about how that turns into $100 million in the next 5 years. And so, and that was a really hard fundraise that we snuck by with, just because, you know, again, it's like one of the partners at Bessemer got the product, put it in his home, fell in love with it, noticed that people were coming over and asking him about it. He saw the potential. And honestly, it was small for them. That was a small check. For them, they saw it as a seed bet.
Yeah.
Now, the problem was that, like, everyone else saw it as a Series A, so that my next round was a Series B, and I was just like nowhere near what a Series B needed to be. So it was tricky.
Outside of like the funding and VC world, can you talk about some things where, despite having like a pretty strong strategic background, operation background, software background, where were you like underestimating how hard hardware was?
I also don't want to give the impression that like venture capital is why the company didn't work. I think like,
no, you said that. That's fine. It's their fault.
Everybody it's the venture capitalist's fault. Yeah. Always. I think the best way to understand the amount of money you raise is like, that's the number of mistakes you can make. And we made a bunch of mistakes and we didn't have enough money to overcome those mistakes. And so I don't put the blame on, you know, the sort of financing questions at all. Like, I think there are plenty of people who are naive about financing that are successful in the products they build and the markets they address and all that. So the hardware stuff, I mean, we were just flying totally blind. You know, you read the blog posts, I was going to the talks, I was meeting with entrepreneurs who had been through it before, you know, I was learning the words that they were using, but like, none of it means anything until you're actually like standing in Mexico in a factory watching human beings assemble your product and put them in boxes. That is a crazy experience. Our head of engineering was flying to China, staying up all night, ripping cigarettes with these guys. His only way to communicate was in Java, like writing on the board, to, you know, like that was their shared language. So that's just not a thing in software. Like, the sort of personal physical toll of the travel. And the other surprising thing I'll say is like, the approach to partnerships is totally different. Like, if you're in software world, everyone you deal with is venture funded. Everyone's really looking out for you, and no one's really, you can kind of count on people to do what they say. You're dealing with businesses and partners in hardware who, they've been around the block. They know that you might be there in a year or you might not. And they're also, it's a world where relationships really matter, and where you got to put in the time and meet them in person, and things are going to happen. Like, things are going to get screwed up. But if you react, I learned pretty quickly, if you react with like, hey, you said it was going to be ready on Thursday, but like, now you're saying it's going to be next month. What the hell, man? Like, you got to compensate me for this or something. Like, you just lost that relationship, right?
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
the right way to respond is like, okay, what can we do to, you know, like, is there anything you can do to like get done faster? You know, the approach in this is just very different. You're like, you know, you sign up for JustWorks and JustWorks messes up a payroll payment. You know, you can call them angrily and talk to their investors and they'll like compensate you for it. And it's like, there's no,
for sure,
there's no reputation sort of market when you're dealing with a pretty fragmented set of contractors and designers and whatever. So it's just a very different approach to business and one that I had to get used to, which like sounds maybe a little snobby, but that's where I was. So I learned pretty quickly that relationships matter and you had to really invest in them with these partners. And we ultimately found like a great set of partners, but we churned through a bunch of them because it just like, you know, we weren't getting what we thought we were getting, or you know, they weren't reliable, or we were too small for them, or we were too big for them, which is a problem that's unique to hardware. And something that I don't think people realize, like I think when entrepreneurs, you know, try to think about contract manufacturing, their first phone call is to Foxconn or like some other massive contract manufacturer, and pretty quickly you realize you're talking to like Foxconn's outsourced team,
Squirrelcon.
Yeah, exactly. And the reality is that you'd be much better off with like a much smaller, you know, unit that you trust. And it's just really hard to find those people. So building that supply chain is just like a massive effort and takes a lot of work and a lot of relationships.
When you say you churned through some partners, does that mean you actually like started going down a path with them and then it like backfired? Or you just had to keep searching and searching and searching until you could find someone?
Both. I think like, I'm trying to think of like specific examples, but we ended up doing two generations of the hardware. We turned over most of our, maybe half of our supply chain between generation one and generation two. The half that we kept was amazing and was the bedrock of the company, and it wouldn't exist without Cheryl in Nogales, Mexico. Like she actually went on to do the manufacturing for Mirror as well. And I think has done quite well.
Hell yeah, Cheryl.
She saved our butts time and time again. She happened to be the sort of final assembly house and would do our fulfillment as well. And so everything would arrive late to her. And we would say, Cheryl, we need you to turn this around like twice as fast as you thought, because we made commitments to our customers. And so she would, you know, she saved our asses a bunch of times. So it was a constant sort of, it was constant thrash on that side of the business. Meanwhile, like we're also running like a software roadmap and trying to iterate those features and have designers that are spread across like Android, iOS, the device itself, the web. Is a pretty big effort.
Yeah. Today's episode of the Logger Podcast is brought to you by us, Logger. The Logger Podcast people are talking about Logger. Go figure. If you made it this far into the episode, that means you're interested in hardware, which means you're probably interested in Logger. So go give it a look. Loggerdata.com, LAGERDATA.com. XOXO, we love you. Bye. I'd love to hear about EO1 is like Babyface Jake. This is like the natural extension of the Raspberry Pi into that. And then your second version is, which we have at our office still, and it has some stuff on it, which is awesome. What was the big changes from one to two? And like, do you feel like you at least leveled up as a hardware person between one and two? And you can sort of look at number two and say, hey, I'm actually pretty proud of this progress that I made as like a hardware CEO.
Yeah. I mean, number two was, you know, we had a head of operations who was fantastic. You know, Bill could focus on mechanical engineering and, you know, industrial design. We had a frame vendor that you could snap on and totally change the cosmetic feel of the device. We had a price point that allowed us to price it meaningfully cheaper. So that's all great. Huge mistake doing a second generation. Okay. Huge mistake. Maybe the biggest mistake, if you could point to one like very specific thing, maybe the biggest mistake we made, just like makes no sense, right? Like the cost of spinning up a second generation is so high, both in terms of the team's focus, the number of people you need, that any savings on, you know, the COGS that you can generate, it's like, that'll pay back when you hit your like 100,000th unit. Like, what were we thinking? We needed to sell like 10,000 units. Like, we shouldn't have touched the hardware. And the reality is that like the changes we made to it were, we thought were so important at the time, were like so incremental in retrospect. And obviously it was more polished and I was very proud of it. But from the end user perspective, when it's hanging on the wall, the experience is extremely similar to the first version and made no sense in retrospect.
That comes back to your ego point too, because you want to create a beautiful thing. You know, Steve Jobs makes beautiful stuff, right? You're supposed to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, and I think like in software, the equivalent is like somebody reskinning a product to try to get it to work. It's like, hey, this product will work better if it's orange. And it's like, it's not going to work better if it's orange. Like they're not using it at blue. They're not going to use it at orange, but with absolutely none of the same cost considerations that you described. So if you go back in time, you stick it out with EO1, maybe you eat it on your margin and like try to make it up in software?
That might be the first biggest mistake. Both of those are tied for first biggest mistake. The fact that we got a lot of advice from investors that we should price it below cost and just worry about growth and make it up on the subscription. Like, that is nonsense. The litmus test is like, go talk to the person that built a $50 million business in like Western Massachusetts and go explain to them your business model of like building something and then selling it for less than you than it cost to build. And they'd be like, wait, what? Like, why would you do that? It's like, what are you, Amazon? Are you Google? Like, are you trying to like win the home? And so you have to like, and you can spend billions of dollars. Like, are we building the Oculus Quest? Like, are, you know, it's like, it didn't make any sense for a tiny startup without any capitalization to price below cost. And it totally screwed us because it was one of the things that really kind of made it difficult for us because it made us totally dependent on investors. Like, I wrote a blog post where it's like, there's three ways to finance your business. One is debt, one is equity, and one is customers. And if you're relying on debt and equity, like those are your customers. And those are the people that you're constantly trying to please. And those are the people whose intentions and whose desires you're trying to guess. And it's like, my team is asking me, should we build a subscription product or a, you know, should we make this marketing decision or invest in here? And I'm thinking to myself like, well, what are the Series B investors going to want?
Which is totally
the wrong cycle. My mental energy should have been like, what do my customers want? And as an afterthought, it should have been like, how do I position the customer value I'm delivering to the venture market? But yeah, those are tied for the two biggest mistakes. I would have priced it aggressively. And if it didn't sell, I would figure out who will pay that much for it. That's where I had to lose my religion, right? Like, you can't fight the physics of basic math when you're building a business.
And there was a time when everybody told you that you could. But I do think it's part of getting you onto that cycle of dependency with financial backers that would happen.
Yeah.
Right now, if you were doing a D2C thing or if EO was happening right now, it seems like there's a way better portfolio of options for high quality targeting and advertising and following up. Like, was it as good then? And I just didn't realize, or maybe even better then? Or do you think in this environment, you'd be able to get the word out better and track those customers down?
The tools you use to reach people, they're one, and to generate demand, is that's sort of like the last problem to figure out. I think for us, we had so many prior problems to figure out, like,
sure,
who is this for and what problem does it solve or what value does it bring into their lives? And such that they would be willing to pay more than it costs us to build. And we never had an answer to that question. We could tell you that some people would buy it for less than it costs to build. But we couldn't tell you who's going to pay more than it costs to build. And so that's ultimately like the sort of crux of our problem and the problem that many startups face is that you go out with an idea of who your customer is, what the product is, what problem it solves, and how much they're willing to pay. And if you aren't flexible on one or more of those dynamics, you're going to lose because you're probably not right out of the gate. And we were just like, I was very focused on who I thought it was for. I thought it was for me. And that's lazy product development. Like, it's really easy to build a product when you are the customer. It takes a lot more work to go out and understand the customer when it's not you. So I wanted it to be me. And for me, I had a very specific mission that I was on and a path that I was on. And it made it difficult for me to compromise. What I felt like was compromising was actually just following what my users were asking for and increasing the value in their eyes. And that's what ultimately should have mattered more to me than what I thought was cool.
And what did you think you were compromising?
The headline of our Kickstarter was, this is not a digital photo frame. I think we said like, no slideshows, like it won't change. And that was, we were being very pointed about the fact that this was a step away from the ephemeral nature of the internet and computers and our phones and also your grandmother's, you know, photo frame. And we thought that positioning against that was a good way to sort of make the category cool. And it kind of worked. And then what happened was, as we got into our like 2000th unit, more people kind of outside of our bubble were discovering it. If you looked at what they were displaying, it was like, yeah, it was some art, but it was also like that photo from a vacation that they took. And it was, you know, which is one way of connecting with people you care about. Another was like, you know, a photo of a vacation that you took with a person you care about in it, right? And then it's like, all of a sudden, it's a digital photo frame. And I think instead of really trying to understand that and figure out how we can uniquely accommodate that need, we rejected it. And we, you know, it took us a year to build like a slideshow mode and a playlist mode. You know, how do we make this more like artistic? And we were just fighting our users, which is kind of a, you know, it's an art. Like there's value in it sometimes, but you have to, it's almost like that should be the exception and rather than the sort of primary operating mode.
I think it's really hard because you do have a purpose, you do have a vision, and it is you, but you are getting reinforced and you're told very often position and niche up, really like own a space. And so like by saying we're not a picture frame, like if you had run that by me, I'd be like, yeah, cool, like go for it. But I guess the fact that there weren't enough people there willing to like accept that message maybe needed to be an indicator. And hearing you describe it now, I wonder if there would have been some cool, this is going to be so lame, old Jake would have hated this idea, but like a mashup of that kind of GIF art with your own photo in the same way that like Snapchat filters and things like that, like change the experience of a thing where you could have sort of made your home photo more appealing than somebody else's digital photo because of the collaboration between some artists or something like that.
Yeah, there's something there. And I think a more open-minded approach would have led us to something that maybe would have made the product a little bit easier to grok for, you know, a larger group of people, but also kind of introduce them to something that maybe they were surprised to find value in. You know, at some point we had the opportunity, you know, the end of the story is basically that we never reached escape velocity. We struggled to raise our Series B. We had an opportunity at the last minute to raise like $1 million or something and do a reset and take the product, take the hardware, take the software, basically like stop investing in new hardware, just like continue to make the thing, find a new audience. We had some ideas about like corporate environments and hospitality. And I was on the verge of accepting the money just to keep it going. The context is this was like the worst 6 months of my professional life, like leading up to this moment, struggling to raise financing, trying to find a buyer, all that stuff. And I had a call with Finn actually. And he was like, look, we'll participate in this round. We'll put the money in and help you get to $1 million or $1.5 million or whatever we were doing. And he's like, but you don't have to keep doing this. If you don't want to like build a corporate digital signage product, you don't have to do that. That's not what First Round signed up for. I don't think it's what you signed up for, Jake. And like, it's probably not what your team signed up for. So like, you don't have to keep going. And that was a pretty pivotal conversation for me.
Yeah.
And it's why we decided to, you know, quote unquote, sell it to Giphy. We ultimately like found a home for the product. We wanted to make sure the product was taken care of, the customers were taken care of, and Giphy has been a great steward of that over the last 4 years. But at some point, I think, you know, to your comment about letting go of your vision, at some point we just said like, actually, like we're going to hold on to it and we don't really want to work on this other vision, and that's okay.
Well, one, what a very cool thing for Finn to say. That's not a normal, because like at this point, the investor's like, no, you keep working for me. I want my money back. There are plenty of investors who would be like that, you know? That's a really encouraging story. And then that's beyond the photo frame. You were being encouraged to go into like some more corporate, like you were asked to take the vision like way out there as part of the race. Is that right?
Yeah, it was well beyond. It was like a new, I think one of our sales guys had sold a bunch to, you know, like 20 units or something to a hotel or a restaurant. Like we were starting to get pull from these various places. And we realized that the solutions there, you know, were kind of weak and maybe there was an opportunity. It just like wasn't, we were grasping at straws and, you know, it was time to just let the thing end, which actually Cameron, you and I have talked a lot about, like, why can't things end? Why can't there be like beautiful things that start and have a beginning and an end? And it's kind of anti-capitalist, but that's kind of how I see Electric Objects. Like we put 3,000 of these into the world. You know, I think some of them have stopped working, unfortunately, but also, you know, hardware has a lifespan, but some of them are still kicking and it's great to know that there's still a community out there that's benefiting from them.
That's beautiful. I also think a lot about your vision thing, because I think it's very tempting to go back and say, oh, what would I have done? Maybe I should have done more to appease, but then like, if you're not going to get up in the morning and want to work on this company, you know, like why do it? I think you assembled a pretty shockingly talented team. Wouldn't you agree? Like, do you feel like, did it give you any confidence in like your recruiting ability? Cause I feel like even Zoe from the beginning, I don't know, Bill, but Zoe is great. You had Eli and Luke who were great. And then didn't the Mirror founder, wasn't she at, or did I make that up?
a bunch of my team went and worked on Mirror, consulted on Mirror. Like Lori, our head of ops, who's amazing, went to Mirror and ran ops for them. But yeah, it was an amazing team. I mean, I chalked that fully up to the ambition of the idea. What creative technologist doesn't want to work on bringing digital art into every household? And so that was appealing. And I think just the scope of it, like doing hardware and software and subscription and media, and like it was people, I think people are attracted to ambitious, crazy things. And art, I think in particular, attracts like really creative, you know, really creative people. So it was a very lucky, you know, intersection of like ambitious idea, like in like artistic space. And we also, you know, I think a lot of it was we partnered with like Ben Perot early on, who has his like fan base and, you know, a great aesthetic and really set the tone for us. Poor Ben, I took him through 6 months of like the most painful naming and like style guide design, which is another like, why did I spend so much time on that?
It's fun. And the outcome was good. I love the branding. I think it's
awesome. A good brand. He did an amazing job. And that kind of set the tone for like, you know, for the next group of people to join. So that was important too.
Well, so the other thing is, I don't think it's luck, because you've basically said that you did it on purpose. Like it wasn't this lucky intersection of all these things. Like you wanted to build that intersection of all those things. And then you found those folks. It might mean losing such a great team to acquiesce on certain like consumer demands, which is tricky. Like you thought maybe we can change the world in this way. And the science experiment proved no, at least for that time period. And so, or with the mistakes that you made. And so somebody else can try another time. I'm sure there probably are similar things now or something, but you know, you're also like community building. There's so much to what you're doing. You're like doing curation, community building, art. It's wild and cool. I can see why people would want to get involved.
Yeah. You know, I've thought about like since then in various periods, like in between roles at other companies or startups, I'll think about like, you know, should I start another company? And I'll riff with people and we'll come up with what about like a network for lawyers or like some kind of random idea. And it's like, you just know that those ideas, I don't know, maybe they're like more likely to result in a financial outcome or more likely to work or find fit or whatever, but you're not going to assemble like the most badass crew of creative technologists that you can imagine, right?
Because what are you going to say on Monday? What are you going to say? You're like, hey, everybody, we're going to get these lawyers talking like they've never been talking before. Lawyers love talking. What do you say to get people pumped? I know there are people who can do it. Like, I think that superhuman guy does a good job of getting people pumped about email. But I do think that it definitely means a different kind of business. I call those things opportunity startups, where it's like, that sounds like a really good opportunity and you'll make money on that. And like, I pretty much only like purpose-driven startups. Mm. So I like have a sole interest in that. And that purpose doesn't need to be grandiose, dent in the universe crap. It could just be like, this is the thing I love more than anything. And I want to make that. And I'm like, cool. That sounds very, very, very great. But if you're telling me like, oh my God, let me tell you how juicy this market is. I don't. Why did you call the market juicy? First off, gross. Second off, I don't want to hear anymore.
Totally.
Yeah. Just to think about like taking you back to winding it down. And then I want to look forward. We're in the past.
Cool.
You're a man of the future.
That's right.
So once you had that conversation with Finn, how long did it take you to say, he's right, we gotta wrap it up?
I mean, at that time we were like, it was like day to day. You know, so I think it was the next day that, you know, let's like find a new home for this. And the team at Giphy was like just so supportive. Like I said, I mean, the inspiration for the product came from their artist community. We had a lot of overlapping artists. They had a Giphy Arts team that was happy to, you know, sort of shepherd the product. I think they had all of our art. We had commissioned over 1,000 original works of art for screen for Electric Objects, and like money in artist pockets, which I'm super proud of. I call that the venture capital art arbitrage.
Nice.
Just like funnel that money into their pockets. And Giphy had it all sent to the Library of Congress to like,
you know, badass.
Which is awesome. Just like such a wonderful thing. So yeah, so we, you know, we landed it with them. We couldn't find there's like no better home for it. And the team all went on to do amazing things because they're all brilliant. And yeah, it was like it was an amazing experience. Learned a lot. Super painful last 6 months, but you know, happy that the customers and the artist community found a good home.
There's a particular moment that I'm very interested in, and it's for purpose-driven startups, mission-driven startups, whatever. There is a language about we're going to do this, right? Mm. And at some point, one of three things happens: you do it, great, cool. your founders give up by getting really acquired, and they go, I know I said we were going to do this, but now I want a boat. Okay. So now I have a boat. Or like, you know, you give it everything you've got and then you can't do it anymore. When do you think, like, how soon before the end? Like, was it like 6 months before, 8 months before? Like, when did it start to feel like, uh-oh, we may not pull this off? Because I know there were a lot of times I feel like you were cranking and you were going through a lot of emotions, but you were shielding other people from that. When does that go past your force field and get to other people? And what does that look like?
I'm having like anxiety, like retroactively. I mean, no. It was a really hard time. I didn't have any co-founders, so it was with me for, you know, most of it. I shared it with my coach. I shared it with my close friends and, you know, and other founders that I could confide in. And then ultimately, the two most sort of senior seasoned folks on the team, I kind of brought them in and said, here's what's going on. Like, I'm going to start looking for a buyer. I might need your help to talk to the buyers. And then finally, it was Lori, head of operations, like, hey, we might need to figure out how to wind this down. And I might need your help figuring out how to wind this down. And then my mind was all about, like, how do I make sure that the team is good? Like, well, my priorities were like team, customers, investors, and then like making, and then if I could get a job out of it, great. Jake. But like, and I really, you know, I was like, I really wanted to make sure my team had healthy severance and was set up well, and negotiating that with the debt investors and the equity investors, and was like really tricky. That's ultimately how it kind of went down. It was a pretty gnarly process. And like being in the middle of debt investors who want to get paid back, equity investors who want to get paid back, trying to sell it to Giphy or other big companies that I thought could be a good fit. And yeah, it was pretty brutal. I don't recommend it. And it probably scarred me for a bit, like, and probably still does to this day. Like, yeah, makes it difficult for me to jump into the next thing, knowing that that's a possible outcome.
And do you think there's any connection between that and your night terrors?
I actually haven't slept in 4 years, so I don't have night terrors. I just don't sleep.
You pulled it off. I think that is probably about as high quality of a solution and outcome that you could have gotten to, and very...
We landed it. We landed the plane. That was the
goal. Is awesome. That's really, really great. And it does speak to who you are, that you would be willing to do that, because it's when you're basically out of energy and you've given up that you're asked to be like, oh, I know we said the marathon was 26 miles, but there's five more miles. It's a bonus marathon and you got to do that.
Yeah. There's a lot of examples of hardware startups that give up when the plane is still in the air, and it's just a disaster. Like, what you do to your customers and your team is just, so I just like, just more than anything, didn't want to do that. And so thankfully we were able to, you know, find a good partner for it.
Would you say that this last couple of years has been a bit of a recharge, even though you're at like companies that are like the big names in technology? Are you sort of like rebuilding your emotional fortitude for like another go? Or are you like, you know what? Big Blue for life. Is that what Facebook is? Big Blue, Blue.
Yeah. I work at Facebook now. I've been here for 6 months. I work on virtual reality, which is a fun part.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a fun part of Facebook. Funny enough, about a month after I joined, Giphy was acquired by Facebook. So nice. Electric Objects and I now work together again.
Oh, great. That's lovely.
Facebook owns the Electric Objects assets, which is quite funny. I am happy right now. I'm learning a lot. I'm surrounded by smart people. People like Alex Chung, CEO of Giphy, are my coworkers now, which is cool. Obviously, I mean, it's in a kind of a different area code of Facebook, but it's still nice to like know that there's good people here in both my immediate vicinity and in other spots and corners of the company. And I'm like thinking about weird futuristic media stuff that people are just beginning to wrap their heads around, which is kind of always where I've spent my time. And so I'm enjoying it. It's also another hardware company. So like all the fun, seeing that happen at scale is really interesting. A company that can afford to do hardware. And we'll see. I don't know. I probably have like an itch to create new things, whether that's here, you know, on my own. We'll see.
Yeah. And I was going to ask if you were back in hardware, but because I didn't really appreciate that at Facebook, you had found your way back to hardware and media.
Yeah.
That's nice. Do you think that that's like a theme you set out from the beginning, like that's, or that you just have like snowballed your like your prowess at that?
No, definitely not intentional. Post Electric Objects, I mean, Square also was like a. I was at Square for a couple of years after Electric Objects, and that was, you know, hardware is an important component of that business. I like it. I don't think that I would rule out software companies. Certainly, like, if I were to do a startup, a software company has a lot of nice benefits to it, in that it's, you know, it's sort of better financing fit, I guess, for venture capital. But yeah, not opposed to it again.
And you're not opposed to hardware again. So you haven't given up.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Not opposed to doing something new, and not opposed to hardware. I think going into a hardware company the next time around, I'd have like a lot clearer eyes, which is also, by the way, like a problem. Like, I spend as much time like stressing out about like, oh, I'm not as naive as I once was. Although I'm sure I'm naive in many ways. Like, that sort of loss of innocence is also comes with a lot of fear. And I think this is true for a lot of second, third time founders who have trouble like jumping off the ledge because they know what can happen if it doesn't work out.
Very, very well said. You started with this ominous opening thing. The trade-off of that wisdom that comes with now like a flinch reflex that you wouldn't have had before, but you also still have the wisdom, but you've lost this like feeling of invincibility.
I think what happens is you stumble upon your next thing, and you know it when you see it, and the fear goes away because you have to do it. And what I'm trying to do is not force that moment. I'm trying to like learn as much as I can, be surrounded by really smart people, and let that moment come to me. We'll see if that works out, but trying not to force it.
I saw this Werner Herzog interview, some ladies interviewing about how he's writing, and she's like, you know, where are your ideas? Or how do you choose your ideas, whatever? And he goes, it has to be love. sorry. It's the ideas that you love the most. It's the one you must do.
What if you did this whole podcast series in the Werner Herzog voice?
Werner Herzog, electric object was... I think I'm becoming generic German and not Austrian. If I hear him, I'll be able to pull it off.
But you're good.
He does say that. He says, you know, pick the one that you love, because that's the one you're going to put your energy into. It also reminds me, there's a great Bowie video where he talks about when an artist tries to do their work for their audience, it's when they do their absolute worst work. And that reminded me of what you were saying about the VCs. When you're thinking about the Series B VC, basically, you know, you're not doing the art for yourself. You're doing it for what you think somebody else wants.
I love that.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me. It was great.